Good evening, it's Saturday, May 16th, 2020. Coming up, protesters call for justice for workers at the Tesla plant in Fremont and accountability for CEO and founder Elon Musk.
We know that workers have been contaminated at that plant. He has a history of violating health and safety standards, covering up injuries of workers at that plant, racism at that plant.
And since Bernie Sanders suspended his campaign for the 2020 presidential election, some of his supporters are opting out of the Democratic Party.
There have been round after round of attempt to reform the Democratic Party, and it has gotten us nowhere.
With David Rosenberg, I'm Sharon Sabota, and this is the KPFA Weekend Evening News.
The U.S. State Department's Inspector General Steve Linick has become the latest senior official to be fired by President Donald Trump. Trump said Linick no longer had his full confidence and that he would be removed in 30 days. Reports say that Linick had begun investigating Secretary of State Mike Pompeo for suspected abuse of office. Democrats say Trump is retaliating against public servants who want to hold his administration to account. Trump is quoted as saying in a letter sent on Friday to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi that it is vital that I have the fullest confidence in the appointees serving as inspectors general. That is no longer the case with regard to this inspector general. The chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee said not long after Linick's dismissal was announced, Linick had opened an investigation into Pompeo.
Protesters gathered at the Tesla plant in Fremont today to call for justice for plant workers and accountability for founder and CEO of Tesla, Elon Musk. Organizers say Musk has blatantly disregarded COVID safety protocols, putting the well-being and safety of workers directly at risk. Steve Zeltzer is a member of Worker Solidarity Action Network. He says Musk shouldn't be above the law.
What has happened in Fremont, where the Tesla factory is located, owned by Elon Musk, is a multi-billionaire, has said that he is going to disregard the shelter-in-place ruling, and he's going to open up his factory. In fact, he's already opened it up. And there have been no health and safety inspections by OSHA, Cal OSHA. And he has said, arrest me, I don't care, I'm above the law. And we feel that that's outrageous. And the other thing that's happened is the Fremont now is inspecting his plant to say that the police Department of Fremont is inspecting his plant to see if they're up to the standards. Now, what we have to say is it should not be up to the police to decide what the health and safety standards are. We have a Cal OSHA agency. They should be down there inspecting that plant. We're not against plants opening it up, but we believe that workers should have proper health and safety so they're not contaminated. We know that workers have been contaminated at that plant. He has a history of violating health and safety standards, covering up injuries of workers at that plant, racism at that plant. And the fact that he's blatantly disregarding the law at this point means for us that he has to be held accountable.
Do you have much hope for a person like Elon Musk to be held accountable given the messaging and the stance that President Trump is taking on the federal level?
I think that there's going to be a revolt in this country. People are treated like slaves. And you can only poke people in the face for so long and they say enough is enough. And one of the things about working people in this country, we're being told that the politicians are going to solve this. The Congress is going to solve this. The only way we're going to change the situation in this country, in this world, is when people organize themselves to defend themselves. And working people have the power. There hasn't been a workers' movement in the United States since the 1930s and 40s. There haven't been general strikes. But these are the kind of actions we need if we're going to bring down Trump and stop these attacks. We have to mobilize, and working people have the power.
Zeltzer says that workers are being pushed to their limits across the country.
Well, the president of the United States represents the billionaires like himself, and they want to profit and make money regardless of the cost of lives. And if you want to think about The Jungle by Upton Sinclair, which was written about the Chicago stockyards, the conditions that they worked under, their conditions are actually worse in Iowa and Nebraska at these meatpacking plants. When he ordered them back to work under this act, he did not require the companies to provide proper health and safety protection. He left that up to guidance, voluntary guidance. Now, what kind of protection is that to say that the companies who are mostly interested in profits should voluntarily protect their workers?
Zeltzer says Governor Gavin Newsom needs to do more to protect workers in California.
I mean, why is it there less than 200 inspectors in California? So people need to call Governor Newsom and call their legislator and demand, why aren't there more inspectors? We're saying there should be 1,000 additional health and safety inspectors. Why in California with 18 million workers, biotech, all these health and safety problems, do we only have one doctor and nurse at Cal OSHA? We need instruction, we need information. Now our union should be doing that as well, because the unions have a responsibility to protect the members. So they should be providing that. But the labor movement has to demand that the government do its job as well. And that's why one of the reasons we're having this rally at the Tesla plant, not only to demand that he be prosecuted, but also that workers have proper PPE and they're not sent back to work without proper health and safety conditions.
Seltzer says the Workers' Solidarity Action Network is calling for solidarity and unified action between workers in the United States, Canada, and Mexico.
So this is an international struggle. That's how we see it. That's how the global economy is. And that's the only way we're going to successfully fight these people.
That's Steve Seltzer with Workers' Solidarity Action Network.
Negotiations between the U.S. and the Taliban to end the war in Afghanistan have been going on for quite a while. Junaid Ahmed is a professor of religion, law, and politics at the University of Lahore in Pakistan. We asked him about the negotiations and the other players in the conflict.
The U.S. And the Taliban, listeners should know, of course, have been in secret private negotiations for quite a while now. I mean, we're talking about years. They go on, and then, of course, some quote-unquote spring offensive takes place by the Taliban, and the U.S. then reacts with incredible force by airstrikes, night raids, and so on. So despite the fact that they do have these secret meetings in the Taliban offices in Doha, Qatar. So what we have seen more recently is the hopeful prospect of some type of deal finally coming to fruition. And it's important to remember that this is not necessarily because some breakthrough in the idea of how to come about some settlement. It's because effectively, I think that Americans should realize that the U.S. military and the Pentagon, they have realized this is an unwinnable war.
What about the other factions within Afghanistan? We know the Taliban has a certain amount of power there and the Afghan government, albeit propped up by the U.S., but what about all the warlords? What about all the other ethnic factions that don't identify with the Taliban or the government? How strong are they?
Since the invasion and the first regime of Hamid Karzai and, of course, of the present government itself, what they have effectively done is to co-opt the other ethnic warlords into their own power dispensation, basically by cash, by the incredible levels of corruption that have taken place. I think perhaps one of the most in the entire planet right now. The amount of money that has gone both to the government and to the quote-unquote NGO sector, a lot of it siphoned away by, I mean, especially during the Karzai days, by his brother, Ahmed Wali Karzai, the most corrupt drug dealer in the country. And so by the hook and crook, they have been able to co-opt many of these warlords from the other ethnic groups in Afghanistan, including the Uzbeks, the Tajiks, and even some of the Shia Hazaras. Now, one interesting development that has taken place roughly over the past few months is that the Taliban realized that, okay, they may be 60% of the population, because the Taliban are primarily the Pashtun ethnicity, and which is roughly about 60% of the population. And 60% of the population, but they realize they really cannot take control of the entire country. So they have been courting many of the other actual ethnicities as well, and their tribal leaders, if you want to, some warlords in the villages. And the most recent one and the most shocking, probably, outreach effort that they have made have been to the Shia Hazaras, against whom they had committed massive atrocities in the past, the Taliban, because of the kind of deeply sectarian nature of the animosity between the Sunni and the Shia. So they have targeted the Shia Hazaras in the past, who kind of border Iran.
That's University of Lahore Professor Junaid Ahmed.
After the suspension of Bernie Sanders' campaign for the 2020 presidential election, 72% of the Los Angeles chapter of Our Revolution voted to leave the Democratic Party and work to create a new one. Our Revolution is an offshoot of the Sanders campaign, with 10,000 members in Los Angeles who voted to join the movement for a new People's Party. KPFA's Ann Garrison has more.
The Movement for a People's Party and the Los Angeles chapter of Our Revolution held a webinar this week to introduce their collaboration to former Sanders supporters and anyone else feeling alienated from the Democratic and Republican parties. Nick Brana, a founder of Movement for a People's Party, explained why.
So many of us were galvanized by Bernie's campaign in 2016. I myself joined in 2015. Before that, I had worked with the Democrats for many years. I had worked for John Kerry in fundraising on his PAC. I had also worked for Terry McAuliffe when he ran for governor in Virginia in 2013, doing voter protection. And those experiences really made me realize that the Democratic Party doesn't stand for working people and made me almost leave the Democratic Party at that time. But then Bernie came around in 2015. And I was so excited and I joined his campaign and he gave me a position lobbying the superdelegates for him. You can imagine how terrible that was. And after that, I helped found Our Revolution in 2016. And so ever since then, there have been round after round of attempt to reform the Democratic Party, and it has gotten us nowhere. Now the verdict is in. 4 years later, since we committed ourselves as a movement to reforming the Democratic Party, the party is actually worse. It is more right-wing. They managed to find a candidate that is worse than Hillary Clinton in Joe Biden, amazingly. And they have actually shifted to the point where they are getting to the right of the Republican Party.
Jerry Perez, a former U.S. Marine, truck driver, and field director of Our Revolution Los Angeles, described the despair that caused his group to leave the Democratic Party.
You've all volunteered your time. You volunteered your money. You gave all of your hopes, your dreams, your faith. Some of you dedicated your lives over the past 5 years to the Bernie Sanders campaign with the idea that we can reform the Democratic Party from within. Bernie Sanders led us to believe that if we follow him and if we band together, we can change this party. Bernie Sanders dropping out and endorsing Joe Biden was the last straw for our group. It destroyed morale. It killed all motivation throughout the county. The day Bernie Sanders dropped out, I was getting nonstop calls, text messages, and utter outrage and despair all across the county, wondering what we're going to do now. So I answered them, what we're going to do now, I want to know how you feel. I want to know, do you trust the Democratic Party to effectively lead and represent you at the local and national level? We did a survey. We asked all our members, and overwhelmingly, they said, no, we do not trust or have confidence in the Democratic Party to effectively lead or represent us at any level of government. And so at the next step in that, I asked them, okay, what do you all want to do? Here are your viable options. We can go and we can join an established third party already, like the Green Party, or we can continue to try to change the Democratic Party from within, or we can start out on our own, start from scratch, create a brand new party, free from any kind of baggage and with the potential to create a platform that represents everyone.
That was Nick Brana of Movement for a People's Party and Jerry Perez of Our Revolution Los Angeles. In Berkeley for Pacifica, KPFA Radio, I'm Ann Garrison.
One of the big bones of contention in any eventual Israeli-Palestinian negotiated agreement is the fate of Palestinian prisoners. Ramzi Baroud is an editor and journalist and the author of several books on Palestine. We asked him if he thought Palestinians would continue to be routinely swept up by Israeli authorities and imprisoned, often without any charges filed against them.
Yes, of course. And it's a constant, and it will continue to be a constant because the nature of the occupation hasn't really changed in any way. So we are, you know, we see the exact same practices that the Israeli army has carried out immediately after its occupation of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza in 1967. We see these practices continuing until today. So currently we have about 5,000 Palestinian prisoners in Israeli prison. We have over 500 prisoners who are held without trial, without due process, or they call them administrative detainees, which means these are prisoners who are just basically held indefinitely without having to go through the court system. Now, when we say the court system, we're not really talking about a democratic court system. We are talking about an Israeli military court system that is there to serve the interest of the army, not the interest of justice.
What do Palestinians do to try to avoid being swept up? Do they have any strategies to avoid the Israeli military, or is that not possible?
Yeah, there's very little they can do about it. Since, you know, when a military power is in control of a certain area, that area is closed off. As we know, in Gaza, the entirety of Gaza is under blockade, under an Israeli siege. The West Bank is divided to various zones, A, B, and C. The towns are closed off by military checkpoints. People are walled off in their communities by the Israeli apartheid wall. You know, it's not easy, if at all possible, to escape the arm of the Israeli military. If they want you for interrogation, for prolonged detention, for imprisonment, they know where to find you. And those who refuse to be apprehended in such a way, they often find themselves shot or killed or are on the run.
What sustains the Palestinian population during this time, knowing they can be swept up and imprisoned, knowing that the occupation is continuing? What gives them the will to resist? What gives them hope?
Exactly. Well, this has been going on for such a long time, and the nature of the battle has been demarcated as such. The Israeli army, and you know, is the arm of the Israeli government. It's a colonial government. It's a government that has territorial goals and aspirations in Palestine. And you know, if it's up to them, they would like to ethnically cleanse every single Palestinian anywhere in Palestine, in historic Palestine, and in the occupied territories.
That's Palestinian author and journalist Ramzi Baroud.
And you're listening to the Weekend Evening News on KPFA 94.1 in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, K248BR in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. With David Rosenberg, I'm Sharon Sabota.
The coronavirus situation in South Sudan has gotten a bit more complicated recently because of the presence of a United Nations mission there. Matthew Russell Lee is with Inner City Press in New York City. He talked about the role of the UN in South Sudan.
It's the world's youngest country. It broke away from Sudan. There's been a longstanding UN peacekeeping mission there of kind of middling performance, but it's hit a new low this year. This could have happened another way, just as we might say that there might have been cholera in Haiti absent the UN, except the UN brought it. In this case, it's pretty clear, and I've been getting a lot of documents, but first they flew in an international staff. And it's one of the dangers, I guess, of being the UN, that you're moving people around, but there's been a total lack of transparency. They flew in an international staffer who, as it turned out, was infected. They never told the government. We then received as Inner City Press, because people in the UN system, not a lot of people are really covering what the UN does in South Sudan. People sent me a transcript of questions put to the head of the mission there, David Shearer, where they said, well, once you had it here, why were you running these UN buses with no social distancing? They thought it was just national staff, but I've now learned it was all kind of staff. So the problems have kind of mounted. Then they put some of their people under quarantine and they didn't respect it. The international staff, while supposedly under quarantine, flew out of the country.
And what about the fact that the virus was supposedly brought in by an international person? Has that caused a certain attitude to emerge in South Sudan, a kind of xenophobic attitude?
I mean, absolutely. And of course, the UN's response, rather than, and again, I think it is unfortunate, because these things can happen. But the one thing I'd say is, when they do happen, the more powerful party, particularly if it's preaching transparency and free and all these great principles, should have disclosed it. So yes, that has led to quite a bit of anti-UN sentiment. The UN has responded by calling that hate speech and disinformation. And it's true, number one. And number two, here's the really galling thing about it. They refused to answer questions about it. First, I got the transcript of David Shearer being asked about the bus without social distancing. I can no longer enter the UN. Nobody enters it right now. But even before the lockdown of the UN, unable to answer. But they said they would answer written questions. Well, they don't anymore. I sent them a copy of the transcript. I said, look, whatever your side of the story is, I'm happy to publish it, but I think you should answer, how serious is this problem? How many buses? No answer at all. Finally, there was a press conference in South Sudan. I'm on the mailing list there. So I said, let me zoom in, same way we're talking here. And I asked questions in this way to the IMF. I mean, it's not like no answer. Not only did they not say, they no answer at all. It's as if they believe that they can kind of choose the press corps that covers them. And they largely succeed, because people don't really care a lot. And the people that do spend the time covering the UN generally like the UN.
That's Inner City Press reporter Matthew Russell Lee. The movement to create genetically engineered trees is still very much alive, even if things are not moving as quickly as GE proponents would like. Ann Peterman is with the Global Justice Ecology Project. She talked about the efforts to get GE trees approved and the opposition to them.
I think because of the COVID crisis, I can't, you know, that they're very secretive over there, so it's hard to know. But because of the COVID crisis, I think they're running a little bit behind maybe what they were hoping to release in terms of the petition for deregulation. But they did just get an article in the New York Times Magazine that was very much slanted in their favor. So that's something we've been doing a lot of work around, trying to bring out, you know, the real side of the story, the real science, so that people who see that article or hear about it can also hear the side of the story that we've been working on now for 20 years.
Do you think that people who are in favor of genetically engineered trees are generally in favor of genetic engineering?
That has been my experience so far, that when I put out posts, for example, on Facebook or social media that are critical of genetically engineered trees, most of the negative response that I get back is people saying, well, what's wrong with GMOs? GMOs are perfectly safe. Why wouldn't we want to genetically engineer trees? So that's been my experience. I know from the perspective of the researchers, they would very much like to win over to their side people who are interested in conservation, people who are interested in bringing the American chestnut tree back to forest. So that's one of the reasons actually that they're doing this work on the genetically engineered American chestnut, is because it's a very charismatic tree. You know, it has a lot of economic value, and they figure if they can convince people that this is a good tree to bring back for quote unquote conservation, then they can use it to open the door for open the floodgates, for all of the genetically engineered trees that would be behind it, the poplars and the pines and the even eucalyptus potentially, that would be for plantation, forestry, industrial purposes.
So what's the long-term perspective of the proponents of genetically engineered trees? Do they foresee a time when most or all of our trees would be that way, or are they arguing for some kind of mix?
It's my observation and impression that the people that are promoting genetically engineered chestnut trees for conservation are in the same boat, or even, you know, potentially even all working together with the people who are promoting gene drives and synthetic biology and genome editing, all of these other extreme technologies for conservation also. And I think the logic for all of them is very similar, which makes me think that they're all working together, that if they can have these extreme technologies accepted by the public for conservation or for dealing with malaria, or, you know, these various arguments that they're making for dealing with invasive species, that they can then get permission from the European Union, for example, from the Forest Stewardship Council, for all these other GMOs that are not altruistic at all.
That's Ann Peterman of the Global Justice Ecology Project. Some commentators see the coronavirus pandemic as a way to totally reorganize the world economy. Samir Dosani is with Peace Vigil. He talked about the nature of the virus and the opportunities it might open up.
So what's happened is we've had a virus that frankly was nowhere near a worst case scenario. You know, as many people have been really diving deep into some of the scientific literature around viruses, around epidemiology, and so on. And we know that this is not a very dangerous virus. It seems to have relatively low case fatality rate of something under 1%. It's debated exactly what it is, but it's not 1%. It's probably less than that. And we also know that it has an R-naught, meaning that for every person who gets it, as many as 3 to 5 people will, you know, that person can spread it to 3 or 5 people. The R-naught is constantly changing, and this is a seasonal virus. So we don't need to get into the technicalities. But the point is that this wasn't a worst case scenario, but it has completely paralyzed the international economy. It paralyzed all of our systems. It's completely caught nearly all of our public health systems unaware. And it shows that the resilience of our social structures is not what it should be.
I'm wondering if you've observed the world leaders, the world financial leaders, the world political leaders, if they are planning their own sort of reorganization, because I think we could agree that it's not what you're proposing. at these meetings, with the G8 meetings, the WTO meetings, when those happen again, what are these leaders likely to propose? Do you have any sense of that?
So this is where I think we have to distinguish between the tactics and the strategy, right? So, or and even the vision. So my strategy is about reconstituting the world economic order and the world order in general to something that's far more equitable, to something that's far more democratic, right? And I think all of your listeners will understand what I mean by those terms. The tactics to get there, you know, if someone had asked me 2 months ago what I thought of universal basic income, you know, I have a critique of it, and I think there's, you know, it's got a positive side and a downside. But I would have said, look, it's almost academic because no real country in the world is going to really take it forward, is it? So let's talk about other things. But now, I mean, not just now, almost as soon as this started to happen, you had proposals of universal basic income going around Britain, and to some extent to the USA, although to a much lesser extent than it should be, France, the Scandinavian countries. I mean, it's all over. Even here in South Africa, we're talking about how to increase and expand the existing social welfare programs to look more like a UBI, universal basic income. Now, why are these leaders proposing that? Because they want to save the status quo. They understand that when people are losing their jobs, when people are losing their income, they're not spending money. And without, you know, without money being put into the system, capitalism just simply cannot survive. So their answer is what many would have considered a very socialist policy some time ago, which is just put cash in everyone's hands. In fact, it's been shown to be more effective than aid. Aid is not a very effective form of development promotion, for example, or just improving someone's life. But putting cash in their hands tends to actually work really well.
That's Samir Dosani of Peace Vigil. The Ohio prison system plans to resume accepting inmates from county jails to begin their prison sentences. The practice was suspended during the coronavirus pandemic to reduce overcrowding. On Monday, the state will take up to 50 inmates a day at the Correctional Reception Center in central Ohio. Authorities will hold inmates a minimum of 35 days before transferring them to facilities around the state based on their security level and other factors. The announcement comes even as positive cases of COVID-19 continue to rise in Ohio prisons along with inmate deaths. More than 4,500 inmates system-wide have tested positive, or nearly 1 in 10.
And the weather. For the San Francisco Bay Area, cloudy tonight with lows in the upper 50s. Showers tomorrow with highs in the upper 60s. In the central San Joaquin Valley, cloudy tonight with a low of 60. Partly sunny tomorrow with highs in the upper 80s. That's it for this evening's newscast. Thanks to Lola Akamu and Ann Garrison for helping to prepare tonight's news. Carla West is at the controls. With David Rosenberg, I'm Sharon Sabota. Good evening.